Hello and welcome to the Right Dishonourable podcast, screaming into your internet's echo chamber one painful episode at a time. My name's Jimmy and I voted to leave the EU in 2016.
And I'm Jazza, and realised what an anti-British shill I was when we found out that Theresa May actually got some sort of a preliminary deal with the EU regarding the Irish border. A surprisingly large part of me wanted her to fail.
I've always thought of you as an anti-British shill.
There was actually, you know, Facebook gives you memories of you. Like, this was you 10 years ago, blah, blah, blah. Mm. There's a photo of me with, like, a Union Jack badge on my jacket. I used to be really proud of being British.
Are you still proud?
As I've learnt more about my nation, it's gradually descended into chaos, really, and confusion as to who I am, what I'm good for. Absolutely nothing. Woo.
There you go. You are an anti-British shill.
Yeah, probs. What do we do? Hi, we're the Dishonourable Podcast. We meet every week, more or less, not really at the moment, and we talk about politics, social issues, and current events. What are we going to talk about today, Jimmy?
As Jazza has alluded to in his confession at the start of this episode, we will be discussing the preliminary first stage Brexit deal. Is that what we're calling it?
Sure. Okay, it's more of a, like, memorandum of understanding, which if anybody knows about, like, official documents, memorandum of understanding is like, shall we just say that we're going to do this thing but not have any actual obligations? Yeah, sure.
I heard it described as a gentleman's agreement when reading a BBC article.
Which doesn't seem appropriate, seeing as Theresa May was, like, at the thing. She's not a gentleman. She is a gentle woo-man.
Well, you know, either way, it's not exactly reassuring.
And
I think David Davis has been at pains to insist that the deal could still fall through.
No, he's walked back on that now.
Has he? Okay.
Yeah, although Gove insists that this deal means that we are going to spend more on the NHS. I just want Michael Gove to go away. I'd really like him to just leave. Why is he still here?
I don't have the visceral hatred of Michael Gove that other people seem to have.
He looks like a shaved, demonic teddy bear. That's my kind of visceral hate. That's where it comes from.
Purely his appearance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Well, no, not pure. Obviously, not purely his appearance, but also the
also
stuff
his
that comes
actions.
Out of his face. Yeah.
Okay, so we are going to be discussing that and Jazza's hatred for various Brexit politicians.
It's not hate. It's disappointment.
Okay. And following that, we are going to be discussing Bitcoin, which I don't think we have done previously on the podcast.
No, I only really recently understood what a Bitcoin was, which is worrying, seeing as I invested yesterday, actually.
So you're in a good position to explain to our listeners. Who don't know what Bitcoin is, what Bitcoin is.
It's a decentralized teller network. No, that's the blockchain. Bitcoin is a cryptocurrency that is often used on the dark web to buy droogs and, like, mat suits.
I feel its connection to crime is somewhat overstated. By unscrupulous law enforcement officials.
Yeah, why are you asking me when you know that you are by far the more qualified person to talk about this topic than me, seeing as you used to cover this as a journalistic beat?
Well, you probably have a closer impression of what it is than the average member of the public, I guess.
So, great, cool. But yeah. You are still more qualified to talk about it than me.
Okay.
Despite the fact I have, like, money.
It's a virtual currency whose integrity is not insured by a government, so it has no lender of last resort, as it were. Instead, it's insured by cryptography, i.e. computer code, and then its value kind of varies just based on the laws of supply and demand, which we'll kind of get into all of this, but yeah, it's a new form of currency.
There are currently... So it was in the news recently because it recently, at the beginning of last week... reached one Bitcoin was worth $10,000, and then it kind of yo-yoed about, reached a peak of $17,000.
I think it hit 19 at its peak.
Was it 19?
Yeah, I think it went pretty high.
And then it went back down to around like $11,000-$12,000, which is when I bought. I know what I'm doing. Help.
I mean, at the end of the day, it's an asset, so, like, you don't need to fundamentally understand it to invest in it, do you?
Let's hope not. And then, finally, you suggested, Jimmy, an article from The Spectator.
I didn't really put this forward as a serious suggestion, but Jazza has taken me up on the non-offer.
Yeah, no, I'm totally... Well, because it talks a lot about, like, millennials and identity politics and lots of things that you hate. Right?
It also talks about language. So the the articles by Brendan O'Neill of Spiked fame, i.e. Mm-hmm. Revolutionary Communist Party and the shady Living Marxism Network, which mm-hmm. you can Google all yourself. I won't bore you on the details. But basically, there was this research that suggested that a lot of 18 to 24-year-olds thought that the term snowflake as a term of abuse could contribute to mental health problems,
mm-hmm.
Which in and of itself sort of proves the term, that the term is apt, that it's appropriate for describing people.
The title of the piece by Brendan O'Neill is "Snowflakes Are Now Triggered by the Term Snowflake."
It's a funny title, I think.
It's objectively a funny article, but yeah. It is also ridiculous and shows how... It's just very childish. And a lot of the talk about kind of like this whole language policing, identity politics, snowflake millennial kind of things, I feel like most of the childish rhetoric comes from generally kind of like older, generally white right-wing commentators blowing things out of proportion.
Yes, so I suppose we'll get into that towards the end of the
podcast.
Great,
I can't wait. It's going to be brilliant.
Shall we play some music and beg them for change?
Yes, please. Or bigger amounts of money also available. Thanks, bye. Hello, dear listener. Jazza here. Just a quick reminder that if you would like to support this podcast and give us a little bit of a tip, then you can go over to patreon.com/rightdishonorable. We already have a handful of people who are pledging us a small donation every time we upload something. It means a lot. It means that we can put cash towards the cost of having this podcast. So that includes like web hosting fees and generally being able to bring down the British government. Thank you in name to our Cohen patrons. They are Agatha, Dominique, Gemma, Matt and Ollie. You're all helping us start a very mild-mannered revolution. Right, we're now going to get on with the show and start talking about Brexit. Mm-hmm.
So, Jazza, do you understand what the Brexit deal is?
It is... Well, it... wasn't it kind of just clearing up a few of the things that needed to really be cleared up, such as rights of EU citizens in the UK mm-hmm. and UK citizens living abroad, the Irish border...
The divorce bill, as it's called,
yeah.
like £39 billion.
Oh, yes, the amount of money that it's going to cost. And also whether or not we're going to be at the beck and call of the European Court of Justice.
During the transition.
During the transition.
Period, I should
Which,
say.
Which,
yeah.
Initially, we didn't want that, but now we are having that for up to eight years or something.
I think different bits of it apply at different... Yeah, the European Court thing, I think, applies for up to 8 years. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so, broadly, and correct me if I'm wrong, so on those topics, we have decided there is going to be, the UK is going to leave the customs union, but there is not going to be a hard border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland.
That appears to be the aspiration at this point, although...
I'm not sure how those two things are possible at the same time, but okay.
But there's the other problem of that we're going to... basically maintain some sort of regulatory similarity or equivalence.
Yeah, so that was originally just going to be Northern Ireland, and then Arlene Foster decided that... Thank you, I've been practicing.
Is that offensive? I think that could be offensive.
Yeah, no, it probably
is. It would be offensive if it was a, you know, if it was a less white minority group.
Yeah, but I'm Irish. If you go back fine. Like seven generations.
I mean, aren't we all? You know.
Yeah, probably. Aren't we all? Yeah, that's like when Americans say, I'm Scotch-Irish, and like, no, you're not. So what were we
just dismissed the migrant backgrounds of Americans.
Yes, every single one of them. So we have a quite confusing thing, but a decision about the Irish border and whether or not we're part of the customs union.
I don't think
union.
It is really a decision. I think it's...
No, but let's get through the top lines. So okay. We're going to end up paying between 35 and 39 billion
£1,000 Yes.
Over a period of
5 years.
Four or five years. God. Yeah. A period of time.
Over some time.
EU nationals are going to be able to stay in the UK and have a right to remain.
And UK nationals can stay in the EU.
But they are only allowed to stay in the country that they are currently residing and not allowed to claim the same benefits across different EU nations.
But I thought they also could claim the benefits, like if they moved within 5 years of us leaving, they can still claim some of the same benefits or some of the rights of residency.
Great. Okay. What are they?
I don't
Fantastic.
Know.
Fantastic. Yeah. But you're still restricted by the country that you move to. So you will, if you move to like Spain, you won't, and you receive like a retirement in Spain, you're not then able to move to France and get the same rights and claim a retirement there.
Right, okay.
For example.
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
Was there another thing that I've missed?
So did the Irish border, the bill, Irish border. EU and citizens' rights, basically.
Yeah. And we're no longer going to have Lint, we're going to have Galaxy, like proper British people.
Right? I don't even know what to make of that.
Lint is Swiss, it's not even part of the EU.
Wow.
So this was meant to go through and be decided on Monday, and then Arlene Foster was like, you can't basically make it so that Northern Ireland stays part of the European Union.
Yeah, so she's the leader of the DUP, and she kicked off massively because she, her inference was, which I think is probably correct, that is if Northern Ireland became, in regulatory terms, the same as Ireland, but Britain diverged, then inevitably Britain is in England, Wales, Scotland.
Oh yeah, the island of Britain.
The island of Great Britain. Then inevitably Northern Ireland would be drawn closer and closer to Ireland, which obviously...
And the DUP are very, very much want to be the UK.
Yeah.
And this was the initial way of dealing with the Irish border problem, was basically keeping the whole of Great Britain leaving the customs union, etc., but Northern Ireland being an exception that basically stayed within the regulation of the European Union. This pissed off not only Arlene Foster, because she's super pro UK and doesn't want there to be any difference between the regulation on the mainland and in Northern Ireland, but also pissed off other regional governments. So the Welsh Assembly were pretty pissed that they wouldn't be able to get a special deal. Scotland very vocally wants to stay within the customs union.
Yeah.
And were like, well, if Northern Ireland are allowed to do it just by the fact that they happen to be on the same body of land as the European Union, then why can't we? Because our hearts are still there.
Well, there's a very obvious practical reason, which is it's harder to create a hard border between territories that are physically next to one another versus territories that are across the sea from one another.
So we've talked before about the Irish border, right?
Yep.
And you
maybe
were,
I don't know.
I think so. And you, I think, thought that it was less of an issue than I did.
Possibly, I don't really remember.
So the biggest thing that people were worried about was a return to the border crossing checks between north and south of the Irish island that were akin to the times of like the Troubles, where there were huge amounts of like separatist movements and a lot of terrorism. Since then, I've done a little bit of reading and have read up on like on the Norway-Sweden border, which is another example of a border between a non-EU and an EU country.
But Norway's in the... Is it in the customs union, Norway?
It's in the customs union.
But it's in the EEA,
but it isn't technically in Schengen, but border crossings are not enforced.
Right.
They have really minimal border crossings, so it's basically a load of CCTV and there's occasional checks.
Right.
That seemed like something that could have practically worked between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. But because of the history that is there, it made it a lot more difficult.
But I think it's difficult for the UK to set up, say, a border deal between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland without agreeing to the same terms on a border deal between England and France. So I think it is slightly more complicated than that, because it feeds into the whole debate about migration, basically. Which I think at the end of the day is why the border issue is contentious. It's because of migration. I don't think most people give that much of a shit about regulatory standards and that sort of thing.
Do you not think that smuggling is kind of like a little bit of a big deal?
I don't know. Is smuggling a big deal?
Apparently during the Troubles it was a huge deal.
Oh.
But Hey.
I don't know. I think, I mean, this is probably from my largely superficial reading of the first phase Brexit deal, my main problem with it. And I do know that some other commentators have flagged it up.
Look at you, pulse on the finger on the pulse.
Is that ultimately, if you want to be an independent sort of self-governing country in terms of setting your own regulations and also controlling your borders, you have to have a hard border across Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. And ultimately that...
And it juxtaposes with the idea that the Conservatives seem to have at the moment of pulling us out completely of all of the regulation of the European Union. We still had like our toe in, that in the form of Northern Ireland being our toe, I guess.
I guess you could envision a scenario where Britain has certain areas where it maintains regulatory equivalence with the EU for practical purposes. But ultimately, I don't really see how it is respectful of the referendum result to have a scenario where Britain is officially out of the EU and yet abides by all the same regulations that it was abiding whilst it was in the EU.
I still have issues with you assuming what people wanted with the referendum result.
Mm.
Because people like, for example, Dan Hannan, who gets brought up all of the time,
right,
was very clear that he wanted us to be within the customs union and still able to trade freely with the European Union, but wanted us to be outside of all of the political infrastructure.
But he's the same guy that talks about like sort of a global free trading Europe that cuts back on, sorry, a global free trading Britain that cuts back on regulations. So I don't know his position, but in general terms, he seems like a bit of a dunce to me. Like, he doesn't seem...
I don't think he is. No, the biggest problem for him is sovereignty, is our ability to make laws about ourselves and how we are governed.
I don't see how that's consistent with remaining in the customs union. I mean, I don't know. Uh-huh. I don't know his position.
There would have been a significant number of people who would have voted because of that reason.
I don't think so.
Do you not think so?
I mean, Dan Hannan has like, he has a media presence, but a lot of his arguments are fairly esoteric and... Mm-hmm. I don't think most people who voted Leave will even know who Dan Hannan is, let alone know the detail of his particular views. But I mean, you can't simultaneously accuse Leavers of being like, you know, ignorant fuckwits who don't know anything about how the EU is run, and also accuse them of having a complex understanding of like the customs union and the single market and all that sort of stuff.
Have I accused them of the former?
Not you personally, but you know, it seems like a lot of people who say, well, you could respect the referendum by remaining within the single market and the customs union.
But I feel like
do make the argument that, you know, Leavers are fuckwits who are ignorant.
Yeah, but I'm sure there's some of them who say that Leavers are the most intelligent people under the sun. Not many, but I'm sure there are some.
Maybe. somewhat doubt
I will
it.
Scour the whole island of 70 million people and find that one person.
I mean, surely if the EU referendum meant anything, the question on the paper was, do you think
the UK remain as a member of the European Union?
Well, the question was altered, so remain or leave. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It was deliberately weighted so that it wasn't yes or no for either of the outcomes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I don't see how that can be interpreted in any sense as actually, given that leave won, that surely has to mean that you come out of the political union of the EU, which has to include, to some degree, the customs union and the single market.
No, that doesn't. What, Norway and Switzerland exist, and Iceland. They adhere to parts of the customs union. But are not part of the European Union.
The European Union
is just the economic... It's the political infrastructure that's there, that makes decisions about the economic infrastructure around it. But the EU is specifically the Commission and the Council and the Presidency.
I mean, Switzerland had a referendum on its approach to migration where the Swiss populace voted to have tighter controls on migration. And this caused a significant amount of panic among Swiss officials, mm-hmm. because the EU said, if you actually respect the outcome of this referendum, we are basically going to have to cut up a lot of the bilateral deals between Switzerland and the EU. Mm-hmm. I mean, Switzerland is not an independent country in all practical terms.
But then are we not coming across the same problems? Neither are we, really. Well, yeah, based on the amount of free trade and how intertwined we are with our neighbours at the moment.
But I mean, that is a result of 40 years of integrationist policies from British politicians. It's mm-hmm. not really the result of...
Who have been elected by the British people.
Yeah, but largely the British people who, again, to go back to the point, apparently know nothing about the EU. So why would you see that as them as giving a mandate towards further integration?
They do know stuff. I mean, have to be straight.
The most famous example is that Tony Blair wanted Britain to adopt the euro during his premiership.
Mm-hmm.
And had he put a referendum out on that, he would have been rejected.
Mm-hmm.
Because the sort of integrationist stuff is generally been met with a lot of hostility from the British public. I mean, that's just a general view. You can see that as like right or wrong.
Certainly not enthusiasm.
Certainly not enthusiasm, yeah. I mean, even though British people have enjoyed a lot of the benefits that the EU has accrued.
Keeping it to as much as we can, this preliminary Brexit deal, it's been described that Theresa May has bought herself breathing room for now, so that apparently now we're able to start the preliminary negotiations for like a trade deal for once we leave. Or do you think that this is a success as much as it kind of feels like in the tone that people are talking about?
Well, I read in I think it was the Sunday Times about after the problems with the DUP and Arlene Foster, there was apparently mutterings among certain backbenchers that they were going to try and oust Theresa May again. I don't know how much weight there is to that. I mean, there's presumably always mutterings from some people in the Tory party about ousting whichever leader is in power at the time, but particularly Theresa May. But yeah, I think if the deal had collapsed, then there was a risk that she would get thrown out again. But then that is just a permanent risk of her premiership at this point. So
I don't know. I think she's safe as houses until this whole thing goes through. I think she can pretty much do what she wants. Who is going to be willing to take her place?
There'll always be someone
who like slips and falls into the role.
I mean, when David Cameron resigned, I think it would have been sensible to ask then who among the Tory party genuinely would think it would be a good idea to actually take over this role, which of chaperoning Britain out of the EU, given the huge amount of complexity involved and given the high possibility of failure. And the answer is any arrogant politician, and there are plenty of arrogant politicians in the Tory party.
It's most of them, really, isn't it? It's not just the Tory party, I don't think.
You have to have a certain amount of arrogance to think that you can run a country. It's kind of like a baseline thing, right? So if Theresa May were to say resign tomorrow, there would be a couple of people lining up to replace her.
Mm-hmm. All hail the new Prime Minister, Rees-Mogg. But do you think that these preliminary talks are a success? This memorandum of understanding
is a success in the narrow sense that it has bought her more time to actually thrash out a longer and more sustainable deal. They may not prove to be a success in that the next round of talks could collapse for whatever reason. There you go.
Yeah, great. Do you think, so we've also seen in like the Brexit side of things, we've also seen, at least on my side of the internet anyway, some buoyed hopes because now more people in the UK want there to be a second referendum than don't.
Yeah, I've noticed there. I mean, there's been some polling, hasn't there?
Yes.
Also, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know how reliable that is.
No, I haven't knocked on everybody's door and found out myself. I asked everybody, got them around for tea.
But there's also been a lot of thought pieces from noted commentators.
Yeah, exactly. Do you think that the swing in that direction towards a second referendum is ever going to be, say we end up with 70% of the British public wanting there to be a second referendum, do you think that would then be put on the table by ends up being in power?
It would be justifiable on democratic grounds, but generally referendums have been called by prime ministers in order to solve internal party disputes. And it doesn't seem that would help soothe the febrile state of the Tory party at this point. Calling out a referendum. I also know that a lot of the people.
Do you think, you know me, I'm constantly clinging on to the idea that this isn't going to happen.
Do you think there is a genuine chance that it won't happen?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's the most likely outcome, but I think there's a significant chance it could pan out that way.
How would that make you feel, Jimmy, as a Leave voter?
It wouldn't surprise me, because...
No, how would that make you feel? I don't care about how surprised you are. Come on, have an emotion about something for once in your fucking life.
Why are you so desperate to get an emotional response out of me?
Because I think that it's important. If politics for me is at its core, at its, like, the reason I care about it is because it makes me feel emotions about, like, frustration, injustice, anger, hope, joy, elation,
I think
disappointment.
I just find it interesting, though. So oh, I think we're coming at it from entirely different points of view.
Oh God, we're so different, yet so the same.
It would be a shame if, you know, but then again, you could say if, you know, they hold enough referendum and the result changes, the result changes. So in some sense, it would be kind of fair. But then you'd have the argument of like, oh, do we hold another referendum? What if the British people change their mind again? And then you'd forever be going back and forth. So I don't really see how a never-endum is sustainable.
A never-endum? That's not the first person to use
that.
That's
a Scottish referendum reference, yeah. I think it would be bad. And I think the EU has an unfortunate track record of...
overriding internalised democratic processes.
Yeah, the decisions of, you know, the people of the member states, which is a shame.
I will say that I think that there are ways of making that better by having the EU more visible and more present and more talked about in our day-to-day discourse in our respective countries.
Well, the referendum certainly achieved that.
People are, we know more about the bloody EU than we ever did before in the last 18 months, that's for sure. Shall we move on to your speciality, the coin made of bits? A friend of the podcast, Taha Khan, made a very funny joke on Twitter yesterday. Do you want to hear it?
Yeah, go ahead.
I wish they'd find all of these bitcoins and turn it into one big real coin. Or something like that. It's really funny. It made me laugh. No? Okay. can you explain to me, Jimmy, what is it that has made this the topic of... Islington dinner conversations over the past week or so?
Is it the topic of Islington dinner?
Apparently, I heard it referenced as such on the New Statesman's podcast.
Must be true.
Must be true. Yeah, they are the epitome of Islington dinner table discussions.
Obviously the fact that it's shot up in value massively. It was sort of it's been growing for years in value with some.
In 2012. £9 got you one Bitcoin, and there was a buy. I had a chance to like invest in 2012. In that, I thought about it and then decided I had a chance to. As if somebody approached me, I thought about like buying some Bitcoin in 2012 when it was £9 per Bitcoin, and. Surprise, didn't, because I would have been a fucking millionaire by now. And the BBC ran a load of profiles on people who did invest in Bitcoin in 2012 when it was such a low price. And lots of people are now never really have to worry about money anymore.
It might make you feel better to know that Niall Ferguson, as in the economics historian, also thought about buying some Bitcoin years ago because his son thought it was about 3 years ago because his son said it would be a good idea.
And he's like, new thing.
He was like, nah, it's a fad. It'll never take off. Admittedly, since its inception, people have been saying that Bitcoin will be going down the tube one way or the other.
They've been saying that it will take off as a new currency in one way or another. Neither of those things have really happened, have they?
It's taken off as an asset, as a store of value, as a means, something that you can invest in and potentially make money out of.
How much of that investment do you think is based on the idea that it will one day be genuinely useful?
I think it already is genuinely useful. It's useful for people who live in countries that don't have stable currencies. I think because it's obviously... it was made by like a group of programmers from various places, but I think...
Japan was the guy who invented the Bitcoin, wasn't it?
Well,
Japan.
The guy has a... It's Satoshi Nakamoto, I think his name is. But that nobody knows if that refers to an individual person or whether it's a pseudonym or whether it refers to a group of people. Yeah, there's been various attempts to unmask the alleged Satoshi Nakamotos of this world, and none of them have really ended up in anything substantial. It's because his name was the one on the white paper that launched Bitcoin.
Right. Okay.
If you see what I mean.
Which set out like it's kind of ideology.
Yeah, I mean, it was originally launched as kind of this libertarian idea of we want a currency that can't be controlled by governments because... Yeah.
It's a decentralized teller system at its core, which means that rather than it going through a central banking authority, each transaction itself is basically tracked and accounted for.
By a network of computers.
Yes.
That's the rough idea.
And therefore, stick it to the man. Fuck you.
Well, there's been one of the ways that government, like sneaky governments, have collected revenues over the years is by debasing the value of the currency, which is sometimes seen as a stealth tax. Because it reduces the value of the pound in your pocket, but the government isn't actually taking money from you, technically. And it's also part of just this libertarian ideology that, you know, any kind of government control is bad, and therefore you want to remove them from processes as much as possible. So it has an interesting ideological component, but its main use these days is, as I said, people who don't have stable currencies who want to store their money in some kind of assets. It has been used in paying for, like, the famous thing is Silk Road, the online drugs marketplace.
It's not just drugs. You can also get weapons and hazmat suits.
I mean, allegedly, the I don't think they actually proved this in court. I suppose I can still mention it, but the I can't remember what the guy's name is, Ross Ulbricht or something like that, who was the guy in the US who was eventually convicted of actually running Silk Road, was accused at one point of trying to use it to hire an assassin to kill somebody who he thought was going to out the people behind Silk Road. I don't think they prosecuted him on that charge, but it was initially on the FBI charge.
If any of our dear listeners are assassins, then please let us know. Is that how you get your work?
Yeah.
So I feel like the biggest.
I should say, because people, there's a general association that of Bitcoin with cybercrime, and actually most crime is committed via cash, because cash is untrackable, whereas you can track Bitcoins ultimately.
Which is one of the reasons why it's actually such an exciting new piece of technology, because it's you can't have fraudulent Bitcoins.
Yeah.
There have only been something like 16.9 million of them ever created.
That might be true.
I read that before. It could be bullshit. I think it was on the BBC. Valid source. Who knows?
I think that there's a set amount. The way the algorithm works is that computers like crunch data, and like eventually, if you have enough computer power, you can process these process the transactions, and you can eventually get rewarded with bitcoins. And it uses a huge amount of energy. This is one of the criticisms of Bitcoin. Basically, there's a cap on the amount of bitcoins that will be created. I believe it's 21 million eventually. Over time, it gets harder to create bitcoins. You need more processing power. So it used to be at one time that you could run a server out of your bedroom and process bitcoin transactions. Now most of it's done en masse in data facilities in China.
I feel like the biggest kind of debate is bitcoin tulips, or is it gold? So tulips in reference to the tulip bubble, where everybody thought that it was a really good idea to invest in tulip bulbs.
And yeah, this was in the Netherlands.
Then realised that it's a fucking flower. Why are we using this as a way of storing cash and accumulating cash? Or gold, which has ended up being the basis for value for centuries. Which do you think it is, or is it a kind of like a blend of the two? Because when you look at it, both gold and tulips have been ways of storing or investing money and growing wealth, and also kind of like a basis of value in whatever cultures they're in. To what extent is Bitcoin that, and is it just going to end up being collapsing as a bubble, or is it going to end up being the standard for digital decentralized currencies?
I think it will remain pretty volatile, but I think it will, my sense is that it will ultimately become a legitimate store of value, legitimate in the sense that people use it. It will probably be more heavily regulated in future in terms of people transacting in Bitcoin, in terms of exchanges where you exchange sort of what's known as fiat currencies, i.e. US dollars, British pounds, etc., like government-backed currencies with Bitcoin, among other cryptocurrencies, but other virtual currencies. But I don't think it will ever be. I don't think people will ever really buy coffee using Bitcoin.
Although
en masse.
You can in a couple of places in Shoreditch.
You can, yeah. I mean, there are some.
Good luck figuring out how that fucking works, though.
Well, a lot of it involves essentially doing a currency conversion in the moment, which kind of defeats the point of using Bitcoin.
Gets people to go and buy your.
Also, at this point, don't be like buying pizza and coffee using bitcoins, because the pizza might end up being a lot more expensive than you initially think.
When you talk about regulation of the transactions of bitcoins, what do you actually mean? Because the whole kind of idea behind it is that it isn't regulated, right?
Yeah, I mean, well, there's
how does that work?
A distinction to be made between who has control of the money supply. Mm-hmm. In a fiat currency, the Bank of England, for instance, could just print British pounds.
Quantitative easing,
causing inflation, reducing the value of any individual pound. They have control of the monetary supply.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in a virtual currency, nobody has control of the monetary supply. It's all done through the algorithms, through the way the architecture of the currency is made. So there's that difference. But in terms of actually transactions, i.e. I go onto a virtual currency exchange and I trade £100 for whatever that would get me in bitcoins, which would be a fraction of nothing, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And you can regulate the exchange in that you can force them to register to be authorized by the financial regulator, whichever jurisdiction they're based. And mm-hmm. you can enforce things like money laundering regulations. You can force customers of that exchange to do a variety of identity checks, for instance. So that there's various ways. I mean, I don't imagine you did. Did you do identity checks before you...
Yeah, I am now an investor in Bitcoin.
Right.
It's very exciting. Looking forward to being a millionaire. I am doing it less because I understand the integrities of how this thing works, like Jimmy, but because my brother has been buggering me to get involved in it for a while. So I bit the bullet and I'm already up about 3-4%.
But did you have to say...
And yeah, I had to provide a driving license.
Driving license, yeah.
I had to say who I was.
So you can regulate virtual currencies in... You can regulate who's dealing with
them. Yeah, the virtual currency that I now own. I also have Litecoin and Ethereum.
Yeah.
Which are other, like, Bitcoin-esque virtual currencies.
Yeah. I mean, Ethereum is actually run... I don't know much about Litecoin, but Ethereum is actually run by a company and it's related to a number of other blockchain related. Blockchain is essentially the system behind Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. It's a decentralized database,
mm-hmm.
and we could be quite boring about discussing that.
No, but let's not do that. So I, as somebody who is now riding this very exciting Bitcoin wave,
yeah.
Was I an idiot to do so, or am I kind of in the just ticking up curve of like technology adoption?
I mean,
I'm not quite the person who queued up for the iPhone, but I went in the first day that it was released to get one.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, Bitcoin has become more mainstream over time. I think it will increase in value over time. I mean, you said, like, on Facebook Messenger that you thought in the long haul Bitcoin will increase, like, long haul being several years.
Yeah.
I think that's probably true. Mm-hmm, I think it'll increase mm-hmm. in value. I don't think it will have that much use out of being a store of value and a means of people to kind of invest and actually mm-hmm. kind of store their assets. But I don't think you need to understand the fundamentals of the technology.
100%,
I mean, at the end...
People invest in oil companies all of the time and don't understand how to drill.
Well, people invest in passive tracker funds, which just track the, you know, the FTSE 100 index, for instance, which is essentially an average of the share price of the top 100 listed companies mm-hmm. in Britain. Obviously, a passive investor doesn't know the details of those 100 companies. They might know mm-hmm. one or two.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean that it's a stupid way to invest.
Mm-hmm.
By definition, as a shareholder or as an owner of an asset, there's a limited amount you can know about that market unless you literally make it your full-time job,
mm-hmm.
which is why people do hire active investors. But I think, generally speaking, passive investment gets better returns than active investment.
Really?
Yeah.
That's good.
Well, that's like an ongoing controversy in investment, but yeah.
So we've gone from Brexit to Bitcoin and now to snowflakes.
Hmm.
So as we said in the introduction, Brendan O'Neill of The Spectator, but also of Spiked fame, wrote a thought piece where he thought about snowflakes now being triggered by the term snowflake. What do you, as a fellow millennial, and actually you have more of a right to claim the millennial banner than I do because you were born in the 90s. What do you feel about this kind of idea that millennials and young people these days aren't worth the carbon that constitutes them and are all really sensitive to the world and should just grow a pair of testicles or ovaries and get over it?
I don't know. I don't know that Brendan O'Neill's saying that millennials are not worth anything to the world.
I don't know. It seemed a pretty vitriolic.
It seems. I mean, intuitively speaking, I think our generation is probably more sensitive than previous generations. But I think that's actually a good thing, in as much as, obviously, there's an argument that you can overdo this, but like parents are more like sensitive to say things like bullying and the attitude of like if anything horrible happens to you, you just sort of have to toughen up and take it in respect to like
stiff upper lip.
Well, kind of everything from like issues of sexuality and sort of ethnic minority concerns and even things like sort of like child rape in previous generations were kind of swept under the rug. So to a degree, I actually think it's a good thing that millennials are snowflakes. But I also think that there are obvious examples on the internet, and I think the internet has made this far more apparent than it otherwise would be, of people overreacting to stupid bullshit.
Yeah, but haven't people always reacted to stupid bullshit?
Well, I think they have more of an audience now. They're more prominent than they used to be.
Don't you remember stories of like a village picketing the house of a paediatrician because they thought they were a paedophile?
Yeah, I've heard that story.
This kind of shit has always happened. And actually, O'Neill, in his piece at the very end, says that he doesn't actually not like the word snowflake. He thinks that it is a shallow and ahistoric word. It has become the right... it's become to the right what the cry of fascists has become to the left, a catch-all brand designed to write off whole groups as wrong or stupid. The problem that he has is that it was something like over 50% of young people in this survey said that being called a snowflake or calling millennials snowflakes was damaging to individuals' mental health. He seems to have a problem with that. Like it makes.
I do... have a problem with people that think that words are a form of violence, which is explicitly what some social justice warriors and that sort
of thing
say.
But it is possible. But it is very possible for people's words to inflict
pain. Psychological
pain. And to
cause
problems with people's mental health. So actually, that's quite an intelligent response from the snowflake millennial.
Ultimately, I don't think you can have free discourse without allowing that injury to take place, or allowing the possibility of that injury to take place.
So. I don't know how much you actually buy into this, but a lot of the conversations that we have are about these things of freedom of speech, where people get non-platformed, get disinvited to particular things because they have outdated or particularly unsavory views about particular topics, and especially in places of learning, university campuses, people seem to be worried that there aren't young people aren't being given a chance to debate people with different views to them. I call bullshit because I think that this doesn't happen nearly as much as the media would want us to have.
It might not, but it still does happen. It still is wrong when it happens.
Yeah, and they're always going to be idiots. And I think that most people, the vast majority of millennials, agree with you that it is bullshit and shouldn't happen.
But the
problem is we get such a high saturation of these kinds of stories about... young people not wanting to have debates with people who have different views to them, that we end up with the whole generation being tainted with this brush, which just isn't true.
I don't think it is the whole generation. That's not the argument I'm making. It's the argument that Brendan O'Neill is making, which I don't think it is, because I think in that piece he actually says, I'm sure there's lots of sensible millennials that don't buy into this crap.
He basically rants for about 600 words, and then the next 200 says, I don't really think this way.
Yeah. it's a problem when it does happen. And it is on. But, you know, it is a genuine argument made by people. And, not, you know, ultimately, it's kind of an adaptation of the justification for hate speech prohibition. Mm-hmm. Is that if you allow somebody to say these words, the cumulative long term effect. The sort of indirect effect might be terrible, therefore we have to ban those words.
But then people also have, as well as the idea of the freedom of speech, people also have the right to not hear people's speeches, especially when they control an organisation like a university or a student union.
Well, you don't have to turn up to these lectures, do you?
Or you could say that the person isn't welcome here. We don't want this person to be... to be endorsed by being invited.
No, it's not an endorsement. It's just not an endorsement, is it?
It can be seen as an endorsement.
I mean, we, in the magazine I currently write for, we run opinion pieces from people who disagree with our organisation, with the general view of our organisation, or the official view of our organisation. That doesn't mean we agree with what they're saying, by definition.
No, sure. Cool.
And just, you know, just because you invite Milo Yiannopoulos, for instance, right-wing provocateur or whatever he's branding himself as these days, just because you invite him doesn't mean you agree with what he has to say. It means you want to hear, or like a certain portion of people want to hear what he has to say.
Mm-hmm.
And just because you want to hear what someone has to say doesn't mean you're going to agree with what they are going to say. In fact, you know, if you never read anyone you disagree with, then you're an idiot.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, maybe you're right.
Oh my god! All right, we can finish the podcast now. I mean, for good.
Yeah, like, for good. This is gonna be we haven't even got to episode 100. No, I do still fundamentally believe that people have the right to not have to.
People have that right, but the argument we're having.
So hold on. When you're talking about students, for example, right, where they pay fees and where speakers get invited and their fees then go towards these individuals' pay, I think that they have a right to say, I'd rather you didn't pay this person to come
speak. What if they're not being paid? What if they've been invited to speak for free or they've waived their fee? This happens very commonly.
I don't want the facilities of the organisation that I pay for to be used to house this person. I think that that's a valid
really
argument.
No. Do you really want to attend a university where a majority of students, or even a vocal minority, can stop people they disagree with speaking?
I don't think that
that's
they should.
That's an insane policy.
I don't think it's an insane policy. I think it makes sense if it's done democratically.
If a small society of say atheists wants to host Richard Dawkins and, you know, a load of angry religious people of whatever denominational faith they might be, says, no, we don't want Richard Dawkins speaking at our university.
Then they,
go fuck them. You know, those people are arseholes. They should just allow people they disagree with to come in and speak. And if they don't want to listen to the guy they disagree, they are free either not to attend the event or to like write nasty things about the person online afterwards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's why we brand these people as snowflakes and we mock them, because they have contemptible opinions.
But then we have the problem of branding everybody who goes to university at the moment as a snowflake who doesn't want there to be freedom of speech on their campus.
Well, I think that's right.
And that just isn't the opinion of the majority of people.
But how many opinion writers have actually said that all millennials are awful snowflakes?
I think that it's implied in an awful lot of writing at the moment.
Okay.
I would argue. I don't have any empirical data.
I haven't seen those articles, but yeah.
I mean, the article that we're discussing at the moment is an example of one of them.
I don't think it does, though. I think it says explicitly otherwise.
He literally says snowflakes. The title of the piece is Snowflakes Are Triggered by the Term Snowflake.
But then he's talking about snowflakes.
And then talks about millennials want people to stop calling them snowflakes because it damages their mental health.
Does he mean millennials in like a general sense?
Many millennials now behave like...
Many, not all.
Oh, that's okay then.
Many, not all.
I would say a minority of millennial. Oh God, it just seems... It's very silly. This was a silly piece by a silly man.
Maybe, yeah. But he's still right about certain things.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you're also a silly man and you're occasionally right.
Well.
But not this episode. Jimmy, where can they... find us if they want to
tell me how great I am.
Yeah.
At JDE Nichols.
On
the Twitter.
Yes. You can find me at JazzaJohn. And, the podcast. at Right Dishonor. Support us on Patreon because we like that. Helps a lot. Mm. Rate us on iTunes because that genuinely helps us grow the audience that we have here. Have a chat with us. See you later. We're going to have one more before Christmas.
Does that mean we're going to have episode 100 as the first episode of 2018? Okay.
Isn't that nice and round and like... Isn't that nice?
It would also have been round to have the last episode.
Yeah, before. But then it ties you into doing another 100 with me. I feel like if we start 100 and then go through to like 200, like I'm just making sure that you stay.
Okay.
Don't leave me.
That's fine. All right.
Okay, bye.
Bye.